And it's time for episode 27. Thanks for joining us here. We have, as always, a fantastic show. We're going to be talking more about animation. Sam's going to continue his industry trend look at the history of animation in movies. We'll have a trivia question. We're going to present a Film Buffs Dictionary entry, this one on something called the auteur theory, something you've probably heard about a lot and something that gets kind of interesting to discuss if it even really is valid or not. We're going to do our top six list this week on the top six actors we'd like to have do monologues in movies if we were making movies. And we're going to round things off with a director's spotlight on Peter Bogdanovich. I'm Stephen Keller.
And I would be, or not to be, I just can't take it anymore. Go to the windows. Would you cast me in your movie, Stephen? Just out of cue, before I go put my whole heart into this monologue I had prepared. I mean, just with.
Well, yeah, actually, I would. On account of my movie is going to be an intentionally bad movie, so I'd really want you in there. It's kind of like a Plan 9 kind of thing.
Okay, well, can we credit me as Stephen Keller?
No, I'll credit you as Alan Smithy.
All right. I don't think we got my actual name into this yet, so I am Sam Stoddard. So for part three of our series on animation, we're going to talk a bit about anime, which means animation, but we use the term here to refer to Japanese animation. Stephen, give us a real quick sense of what anime is like.
Oh, those no tokudowa. Oh, ah, oh,
boink. Sweat drop. That's pretty much every anime ever. Unless you watch the dubbed versions of anime, in which case it's like, oh, I am going to the store. No, why are you going to do that? It's because the
That's a lot less interesting, actually.
Yeah, that's why I don't like watching the dubbed anime.
Yeah. Okay. Well, anyway, anime. You know what? We don't really need to say any more about it at this point, do we? You pretty much summed it up. But anyway, give a little history here. It was first seen in the United States in 1963. Anime started very early on in Japan, you know, right when film was being developed, and then it had a lot of money to do live-action stuff, so they started experimenting with animation. But it didn't come to the United States until 63 with the television series Astro Boy, and there were a few others in the 60s, too. Speed Racer is one that some people fondly remember, I guess. But anime was a very niche thing in the 60s, and I don't know that people were particularly excited about it. You didn't really see much in the 70s at all, but in the 80s, more anime started to trickle in. And I think the real turning point when people started to look at anime as something with its own style and merit was the film Akira in 1988. And I'm not thrilled, you know, exactly with Akira myself. It's pretty weird and cryptic, like a lot of anime, I guess, but it does look good. It has considerably better animation than the anime that had been seen in the U.S. before. Very unusually high-budget, full animation. You didn't see these static shots of characters with only their lips moving, which was very common. Very detailed animation in Akira, and the voices were pre-synced, so it looked a lot better when you see the characters speaking. I remember when Akira came out, I remember people talking about, I wasn't really aware that it had come out, but when I started talking to people about animation and things in say, the early 90s, you know, what's your favorite animated movie? Well, they'd make their top 10 lists, you know, and the number one was always Akira, a lot of the time, anyway. And then the next nine were all Disney features, because that's what there was to choose from, Disney and Akira. And I hadn't seen Akira at that time, and I didn't even know where to find it, actually, but I was pretty intrigued, because people would say, oh, well, Akira is the best animated movie because it uses this many cells, and which is way high, and so the animation quality is better, and they painted the cells this way, which makes them more colorful, and on and on. And then when I finally saw it, of course, I was a bit disappointed, because it, you know, it looks like an animated movie that looks good, but I understood where they were coming from, though, because Akira was not like anything we'd really seen in the United States before, except in really niche markets. But Western animation had become a family affair for decades, and here was this hard science fiction story with big action scenes and nuclear explosions and all that. I mean, what'd you think of Akira, Stephen?
I saw Akira after I actually watched a lot of other Japanese animation, and I don't know. I kind of agree with you. I think there's like a lot of storytelling problems. It's like a condensed version of a much, much larger story that was originally published as Japanese comics. And so I think it doesn't make much sense. I agree with you. And I don't know. Like a lot of the violence toward the end just seems kind of gratuitous and just weird for weird's sake. I'm not that thrilled with it. And I don't think it's a very good real representation of all Japanese animation. I think people got exposed to that and it got maybe just turned off. Because certainly there's a lot of that kind of sci-fi-ish, hard, violent kind of animation, but there's a much wider range and variety out there. I think it's too bad that it was so many people's first and only exposure to this style.
Yeah, and I want to make that point, too. Anime is not probably what you think it is if your exposure to it has only been with one or two things, because it's like, you know, it's like looking at one movie, a live-action movie, and say, oh, I don't like the movies because it was Poltergeist, and really what you would have liked was, I don't know, pick a comedy. So anime really has a broad variety of genres and target audiences. A lot of it's made for kids, some of it isn't. But with anime here, I think Akira made such an impact because it was so different from anything we'd seen. And so the people that liked that kind of thing definitely had not been getting it from animation in the Western world. And suddenly they got this wonderful thing that was new and different. And even if it had all kinds of problems, it certainly opened the doors for more anime to come over. And in the 1990s, a whole pile of it made its way here. In particular, anime with more of a distinct Japanese flavor than what we'd gotten before. In the 60s, what came over was the sort of more universal things. It wasn't so tied to the Japanese culture. But now that we have that sort of thing, a lot of kids and teenagers at the time started to become interested in Japanese culture through these shows, which is, I suppose, a good thing. It broadened horizons at an unusual time and an unusual age.
Yeah, you know, it's funny you mentioned that a lot of the things we got in the West didn't seem distinctly Japanese. In part, that's because the distinctly Japanese parts were often removed from them.
Yeah.
I mean, there's like a lot of cartoons that are aimed at like kids and stuff. When they get over here, they remove any, or at least did remove references to like rice balls and that kind of stuff. I remember they changed like rice balls into like cake or something, which didn't make any sense at all. But again, there was a sense for a while that American kids couldn't handle the concept that what they were watching took place in a different country. So they went out of their way to try and just completely hide it.
And we still get that. You hear about movies being made, like the Wonder Woman movie that they want to make. You know, I think somebody wanted to make it in the World War II era, which is when these comics started coming out, and that was the best season of the TV show, was when it took place in World War II, not later on in the present day stuff. And the producers, it'd be appeal to more people if it took place in the present day. Well, baloney. I don't know. I don't understand that. There's a strange mentality that things have to be about our specific experience to be acceptable. And I think people want to go to exotic places and times, maybe not all the time, but certainly the door is open more than I think producers think it is. Unfortunately, anime movies still don't get a lot of exposure here, but you know, as opposed to television shows, but certainly more than they ever have. And things like, every once in a while you get a theatrical release of something like Princess Mononoke or Spirited Away. They get U.S. distribution through Disney in these particular instances with pretty nice dubs. I mean, subtitles are still better, but a good dub with real actors is miles better than a really bad dub, which Stephen gave us the impression of a little bit earlier. But basically, though, when it comes to anime in the United States, most isn't really that good, frankly. Sorry if I'm offending anybody, but it's a Saturday morning cartoon type stuff. It's intended for kids, even if it seems somehow more mature than American children animation. It's mostly pretty shallow. But I respect its fans, actually, because the fact is American children's animation has become so ridiculously horrible, really cheap and annoying and watered down and stupid, that of course people are going to be more interested in something with some more life in it. But whether you love anime or hate it, you know, as I said before, I think it's a mistake to think it's just always this weird kid's science fiction or whatever. There's a lot of different types out there. For example, Grave of the Fireflies, the 1990 film by director, I don't know if I can pronounce this right, but Isao Takahata, something like that. It's about a couple of children who are orphaned during World War II, and they have nobody to take care of them. All the adults around them seem to take the attitude that it's not their responsibility to take these kids, even their own extended family. And so the kids are on their own in the midst of this famine that's taking place, and the film is just a very difficult, very powerful, very moving situation. The film has been compared to Schindler's List in terms of its emotional resonance, not really its plot, obviously. But honestly, I think it's the single saddest movie I've ever seen. I mean, that may or may not sound like a recommendation, but it certainly says a lot about its power as a story and a film, and I think it's absolutely nothing like an episode of Pokemon. What's your favorite anime movie, Steven?
Oh, man, that's... I'm a big fan of Miyazaki, personally. I really think Princess Mononoke, especially when I saw it in the theater. I saw it on video before, and I saw it was a theatrical release. I think that's a wonderful, like, just epic movie that has interesting shades of gray all around. One thing I like about that movie, especially, it's sort of a battle between several different ideas. And each of the ideas, I think, is presented somewhat fairly, and it's sort of a more nuanced take on the idea of the clash between nature and civilization than you normally get. It's not clear that one side is right and the other is absolutely wrong, and it's sort of arguing for some kind of middle ground. And all that in the middle of being a really cool action-adventure type movie. I think that's a really stupendous film, personally. I don't know if that's my favorite, though. I'd have to give some more thought to pick a particular favorite. But yeah, Miyazaki is pretty much always a can't miss, you know, whether he's doing like just complete and total children type stuff like My Neighbor Totoro, which is a really fun film, or just crazy Alice in Wonderland type stuff like Spirited Away, which I think is one of the most gorgeous cartoons ever made. I don't know. Miyazaki is definitely my favorite of the great anime directors.
Yeah, I love Miyazaki as well. And in fact, later on, as we continue to talk about animation, I want to do a director's spotlight about Miyazaki, so I'll save a lot of comments for then. Spirited Away is, I think, the one that resonates with me the most. It's just this... we'll talk about it then. So, next week, we will talk about computer animation and how 3D animation works and how it's affected the industry and all that. So, all you geeks out there will certainly want to catch next week's episode. Well, I got a short trivia question for you this week, and it's a pretty simple one. What character is in the Guinness Book of World Records for appearing in more horror films than any other character? And we'll give you a bonus point if you can guess the number of films that that character's in. Keep listening. Toward the end of the show, we'll get back to the answer. Well, we've got another entry in our Film Buffs Dictionary for you, and we're going to define a term called auteur theory. And it comes from the French word auteur, and that means author. And so the auteur theory is going to be a theory about who is the true author of a movie, or mostly the author. And, of course, this is a term used in film criticism. And so to pronounce it correctly, you must be as snooty as absolutely possible. And so basically it came around by a film director, or a future film director, François Truffaut. And we've talked about before, we mentioned that he was a critic before he became a film director. It was around 1954, he came up with this idea that the primary author of a movie was pretty much always the director. And there are no good and bad movies, only good and bad directors. And that the worst movie of the best director is necessarily always going to be more interesting than the best movie of the worst director. And the idea is that movies reflect the director's personality. You know, obviously a lot of people go into the making of a movie. You know, there's actors, there's writers, there's set designers and everything, but they're all following the direction of the director. The director tells them, you know, this is what I want in terms of acting. This is the kind of set I want. This is et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so, ultimately, the movie always comes out as primarily the work of a director. And that's basically all it means. That's all that snooty term means, the auteur theory. But a lot of words have been written about it, and a lot of controversy about whether people agree with it or not. Obviously, it doesn't go over too well with people like writers. You know, William Goldman, the author of The Princess Bride, when he first heard about this theory, his response was, well, what's the punchline? But auteur theory is still embraced by a good chunk of the world's film criticism, and it was introduced to America primarily by Andrew Saras, who actually coined the term auteur theory, mixing the French and the English. And Andrew Saras wrote for the Village Voice. He still writes now for the New York Observer, but the Village Voice at the time, and he sort of introduced this idea to America, and that's where it became popular there. So he's a very influential film critic, but he had this famous feud with Pauline Kael of The New Yorker, who is another absolutely influential and famous, noteworthy film critic. But Cale didn't agree with this at all. She thought the auteur theory was nonsense, and so they had this battle going on about this and that, and one would come up with a defense, and the other one would come up with an attack, and then they'd respond to each other's counter-arguments, and it was actually kind of amusing. But it's interesting, when you hear this term, you can go back in the world of film criticism. We usually talk about the heritage of ideas in movies themselves, but film criticism has this own sort of hierarchy and ancestry of ideas and stuff and fashions, and these two critics definitely were very important in their day and continue on to today. We still have this division. Well, is this the director's movie or is it not? What do you think about the auteur theory? Is this a real observation about the way movies are made and created, or is it just kind of a...
Yeah, though I think it sometimes gets too simplified to say that, oh, the director is the author of the film. I mean, sometimes you look at some directors who, you know, the best example is probably Hitchcock. Is there any real argument that Hitchcock is sort of the controlling factor in all of his films? I mean, he doesn't always have the same writer, he doesn't always have the same producer, but every Hitchcock film has, you know, really unique characteristics that are clearly identifiable as being Hitchcock films. Even, say, directors that, you know, I don't like, you know, a Michael Bay film or a Tony Scott film is clearly a Michael Bay or a Tony Scott film. They don't really look or feel like anyone else is.
Yeah.
And I think that you tend to see that more with directors than with anyone else. And I think the other thing is, it's sort of a self-fulfilling thing. Once people started to accept the director as the author of the film, directors just got more control. You know, to the point where a lot of directors today have final cut over their movies, so they're supervising even the whole editing process.
Yeah, I think I agree with you that it's too simplified. I was going to make the point that I don't really agree with either of these critics in whole. I mean, I agree with, well, maybe I agree with both of them. Sometimes it's the case, and sometimes it isn't. We talked recently about Billy Wilder, and this is a great director, unquestionably one of the greatest directors of all time, but we specifically made the point that you can't always say this is the unifying theme of all Billy Wilder movies, or all they all have this. You can definitely identify elements that seem like, oh, they're very Wilder-esque. This is sort of the Wilder sense of humor, or this is, you know, whatever, but you don't really get the sense that they're cut from the same cloth. You can't look at The Lost Weekend and say, ah, well, this is the director of Some Like It Hot. So it depends kind of on who it is. And sometimes you get a director who does work with the same people all the time, and once he loses those people, then his movies don't ever quite look the same again. So you get a director that seems like he has this very imposing directorial style, the defining style to it, and then it turns out that it's just that he's working with the same people again and again and again. Let me bring up the two primary, I guess, examples from both sides. For the auteur theory camp, very often they cite Citizen Kane, because it's got Orson Welles all over this movie. I mean, I don't think anybody thinks Citizen Kane isn't primarily the work of Orson Welles, but Pauline Kael would come back and say, okay, well, that's true, but look at Herman Mankiewicz's screenplay, look at Greg Toland's cinematography, and tell me Citizen Kane would have the same identity, the same basic feel, without those elements. And so how can Welles be the, you know, maybe he was mostly involved in it, but he wasn't the guy that gave Citizen Kane its identity. That was a committee. And then on the other side of the coin, Casablanca is the big counterexample to auteur theory. It's weird, because as far as great movies go, the director Michael Curtiz truly isn't seen as the primary force behind this film. Even Andrew Saras admitted that. Personally, I think he deserves a lot more credit than he gets, but Casablanca really feels more like a collaborative effort. The writers were very involved in this. The acting, just the personalities that were cast in this movie define Casablanca's identity. You know, so Andrew Saras admitted this is the, you know, the most decisive exemption to the auteur theory. Kind of amusingly, there was a film historian, Algene Harmetz, who responded to that, saying, well, nearly every Warner Brothers picture was an exception to the auteur theory. If you think about it, it's true, all those old gangster movies and everything. You don't really get the sense that there's a forceful directorial style. And, you know, as I say, some directors have the Hitchcock thing. You can identify a Hitchcock movie anywhere. Other directors, William Wyler, a director, I think, who's been nominated for an Oscar more times than any other director. You cannot tell a William Wyler movie because his style was very adapted. You know, his style was to work with the people he had and come up with a great movie that way, and it didn't always come out the same every time or identifiably every time. But obviously he's a great director. Just his filmography speaks for itself. Here's one for you, Stephen. Robert Altman. Mm. This is a really interesting situation, I think, because he is not a controlling director. If you know anything about the way he works in a very open way. He's always open to suggestions. His style is more or less to set up an environment where happy accidents can happen. And he'll tell you, he was fond of saying in interviews, if you look at any of my movies, pick the five best things, whatever they happen to be, however good or bad the movie is, pick the five best things, and he'll tell you, they were not my fault. They happened in front of the camera as accidents, and he was aware enough to capture them on film. And yet, I think his stamp is all over all his movies. I mean, I can definitely identify a Robert Altman movie.
Yeah, and I think it's sort of oversimplifying of thinking of the director as, you know, when you say he's the author, it doesn't necessarily mean he's the only person who was involved in creating it. At the same time, you know, Altman, though he tried to capture accidents, had a very specific way in which he worked, you know. And,
right.
And that setup, his ability to capture those accidents, to arrange the environment for them to happen, is his real contribution to his films. It's why they feel so similar, his bringing that sensibility. And part of it is that everyone who's involved in the production of an Altman movie sort of has an idea of what it's going to be like. So they're kind of already coming, when they're bringing their ideas to the table, they already have this sort of preconceived notion of what kind of things to bring based on the fact that they're familiar with Altman's work, I think.
Right, yeah. That's a good point.
So it's not, I don't think it's at all a simple thing. I think, you know, we should say that the auteur of a movie, and you should mention that maybe in some cases, it's not the director. I mean, well, I guess you did say that, but I mean, just like some cases, people cite producers or specific writers, depending on how much control they had, as being the author of certain movies.
Yeah, sometimes. I guess it depends on who's talking about the theory. I've seen both, where some people say it's only the director, he's the only one in the position to do it, and others say, well, once in a while you get one that's...
Right, I mean...
But, yeah.
Who's the author of the film Gone with the Wind?
Yeah, that's a tricky one.
It's myriad of directors or writers, or it's producer.
Right. Right.
I mean, who is control over Gone with the Wind? Is it, you know, one of its myriad of directors, or was it producer David O. Selznick? And it's Selznick, who I think you could argue as being an auteur himself, even though he's, you know, known as being a producer rather than a writer or a director.
Well, it's interesting you brought Selznick up, because that segues into the last point I want to make about this, and it's just how filmmaking itself reacted to the introduction of this idea of the auteur theory. Because once upon a time, it wasn't the directors who got all the fame and the glory and everything. They were certainly recognized as being very critical components of the creative crew, but the focus was always, in terms of the glamour and, you know, Hollywood, I'm going to meet the big Hollywood people. It was always the producers. You meet the big Hollywood producers. Oh, I hope a big Hollywood producer discovers me, that kind of thing. The focus was on the producers, and that didn't change until to being the directors as it is now, until roughly the time this idea became popular, actually. And so people writing about how, you know, usually the director is the primary creator of these movies, and then I think that signaled a focus. I mean, there might have been other things, too. Certainly the breakdown of the studio system resulted in perhaps a weakening of producers in power, but I don't know. I think it's kind of tied in with this idea that people were becoming more aware of what directors do. They're the people actually making the movie. And now, today, we don't necessarily know producers. It's actually kind of rare that we know the name of a particular producer. Certainly, we know Jerry Bruckheimer.
Yeah, but Bruckheimer is a perfect example, because you can think of a Bruckheimer film, and you know what you're getting.
Right.
Or also, you know, similar also in the action genre, Joel Silver.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to think of him, too. But those, I think, are very clearly exceptions. We don't tend to know who the producers are and the directors. I mean, I can just, off the top of my head, and restricting myself to people today, you know, name all kinds of directors. And even somebody who's not into movies as much as I am, I'm sure could name more directors than producers. So I think ever since about the late 50s, maybe in the 60s or somewhere in there, we start focusing on the directors more than the producers, as was the case in the 30s and 40s. And so, speaking of Selznick, wrapping this back up to Selznick, it's interesting the mentality shift, because Selznick hired Hitchcock when he came over to America. So we have this classic auteur theory director working for the guy behind Gone with the Wind, probably the primary author of Gone with the Wind. And so it's interesting if you hear interviews with Selznick at the time, or you know, read them, Selznick thought of Hitchcock as his employee. He a very important employee, a guy he probably would find it quite difficult to replace. But nevertheless, he was one of his tools. And I think most people looking back today would say, okay, well, Selznick was the pointy-haired boss, and Hitchcock was the genius. And probably neither view is precisely correct, but it's just interesting to me to see this perception shift over time. So, coming up later in the show, we're going to do a top six first, but when we get back, we're going to talk about a director who's actually a pretty good example of how this auteur theory works and maybe breaks down over time. Definitely stick around and we'll learn all about him.
One of the most fun things about the movies is that great speech that a character gives, the monologue, adapted from the theaters. Some of the best monologues have created some of the finest moments in films. And so today, we're going to focus not on monologues, but on the actors and actresses who present them. And we're going to go ahead and assume that, let's say you're making, Sam, your own movie, and you've got some big monologue that you want someone to deliver. So our top six list is going to be the top six actors that you would want to deliver a monologue in your film. So these are the guys you think are the best at doing great monologues.
Even if they're dead.
Even if they're dead, yeah. So, to get started, my number six is going to be George C. Scott, who, I mean, really could have earned this spot just on the strength of the opening scene from Patton. But think of the guy who has just a commanding screen presence. I remember him in Dr. Strangelove when he gives that great speech about how there's no possible way the Soviets could shoot down his bombers. And I mean, this is a guy who's got presence, who's got charisma, and if you want a guy to deliver a tough speech about kicking ass and taking names, this is a good guy to go with.
Yeah, his performance in Dr. Strangelove is one of my all-time favorite movie performances, period. Well, my number six is Walter Huston, and I'm picking him on the basis of one of the best scenes in Treasure of the Sierra Madre. And this scene has Walter Huston delivering this monologue about what gold does to men's souls, and I think this is also the scene where we have that now famous quote, nobody knows where it came from, but it's the quote about, we don't need no stinking badges. That comes from this scene. But it's absolutely a riveting performance, very funny and charismatic, and more than enough to make me wish he had done more scenery-chewing work like this.
Well, speaking of scenery-chewing, my number five is the guy who sort of made a second career on showing up and chewing scenery and getting the heck out of the way, and that's Christopher Walken. I mean, here's a guy who, in like the last decade or so, seems to do nothing but deliver crazy, zany monologues. But he's also a guy who's a really solid, quality actor who can do range if you need him to. But boy, if you need a guy to come into your movie and deliver a monologue about where your father held a gold pocket watch for a couple of years, this is the guy that you want.
Yeah, and you even want him if you're having a monologue that you're delivering to. You know, it's another character delivering a monologue to Christopher Walken. You think of True Romance with Dennis Hopper and Christopher Walken. Oh my goodness, there's not a sane thought in that room, I'm sure, when they were shooting that scene. But, you know, yeah, he's a great actor. And, you know, it's funny, he won an Oscar for The Deer Hunter early in his career. And, you know, for most people, that's the height of their career. It's Oscar-winning actor or actress, it's the Academy Award-winning, whoever. And, you know, Christopher Walken is, yeah, he's this great, crazy character actor. And, oh, yeah, I guess he did win an Oscar. It's kind of funny how that works. He's overshadowed himself. Anyway, my number five is a much more traditional pick, and it's Laurence Olivier, one of the greatest actors of all time. Certainly, probably the greatest Shakespearean actor, and of course he directed his own version of Hamlet, which he starred in, so he got the great to be or not to be monologue in there, and he won Best Picture with it, sort of an underdog in 1948. So, great actor, I love him.
Yeah, man, that was he was certainly in my consideration. I really wanted a Shakespearean actor, but I didn't quite get around to it. Definitely, Olivier would have been my pick for the Shakespearean side of things if I had gone that way. My number four is a guy who I think gets underrated a lot and kind of written off as just a comedic actor, when in reality, this is a guy who's delivered some of my all-time favorite movie monologues, and this is Jack Lemmon. And, I mean, we kind of think of him as sort of the buddy movies with Walter Matthau, The Odd Couple, that kind of stuff, but really, when I think of Lemmon, I think of his work in The Apartment by Billy Wilder, or Glengarry Glen Ross, where he just has wonderful scene-stealing monologues that are just really heartbreaking and heartfelt. This is a guy who does a really good job of being funny and kind of pathic at the same time. You get a real sense of just angst, and a guy who can play characters who are using humor to try and divert things and trying to cover up some real inner depression, that kind of stuff. Really, not enough credit to Lemon. We shouldn't think of him just as a funny man or a straight man, but as a guy who has such incredible range and is a great choice for a monologue deliverer. Monologuer? Is that a word? It should be.
Yes, it should be. Lemon is great. I don't know why I didn't even think of them for this list. He's one of my top five actors. Top six actors, excuse me, because we do one more. But, yeah, he is good at breaking the heart and really get inside to the core of somebody. Think of Days and Wine and Roses, where he plays an alcoholic, and alcohol basically takes everything away from his life. But he is also very funny, too. So he could do the sad monologues or the funny monologues. Well, my number four, I picked Olivier for number five, and my number four is the other greatest actor of all time that people tend to think of, and it's Marlon Brando, the opposite of a Shakespearean actor, I guess you'd say, but you can think of any number of great performances that he's given, monologues like the I Could Have Been a Contender monologue from On the Waterfront, I'll Make Him an Offer He Can't Refuse from The Godfather. I don't know how long of a monologue that was, but certainly any dialogue you throw at him, he can deliver in an interesting way. He can make it, we talk about screen presence when we talk about actors, and I think that what that means is just when he's on the screen, that's what you see, and it's a kind of presence there on the screen that no other actor can duplicate. Certainly it's very compelling, and Brando's like that every time out, even when he's horribly miscast and making bad movies.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously Brando is Brando, and probably the greatest film actor. Certainly you can make the case for it. Well, my number three is a guy who did have some success playing Shakespearean parts, but also really did a lot of other things and delivered one of my favorite monologues from The Third Man, which I mentioned back when we talked about that movie. And that's Orson Welles, whose speech about the cuckoo clocks coming from 500 years of peace and brotherly love in Switzerland is one of the great moments in, I think, monologue delivery in the movies. But also, here's a guy who, in everything else he did, was just able to perfectly read long bits of extended dialogue. Think of how many great scenes of his in Citizen Kane are practically monologues as Kane rants or raves about something or another. I mean, it's a guy that we always think of as a great director, but I always feel like a little bit he gets shorted in the fact that he was also a really, really gifted, wonderful actor with a great, great voice. I mean, he almost has that sort of classically trained sound to his voice, but who was willing to play a lot of weird and kind of bizarre parts. And unfortunately, sometimes toward the later end of his career, he got into a lot of crappy parts. But while he was hot, I mean, this is a guy who played some of the most memorable characters of all time.
Yeah, great actor. And again, screen presence. When he's on the screen, you're watching him. But, you know, Stephen, I am actually mad as hell. And I'm not going to take this anymore. Because, of course, I'm quoting Peter Finch from Network, one of my favorite movies from the 70s. And it's a satire about television. And actually, quite a bit more relevant today now that we have all this weird reality stuff on TV. A lot of weird stunts and stuff. Very, very relevant today, much more so than in the 70s. It's a very forward-thinking movie. And it is just riddled with monologues. There's a ton of monologues. I can't even tell you how many and how many different people deliver them. It doesn't feel... It feels still very dynamic and interactive, but if you really think about it, there's a lot of long speeches in this, and I swear, every single one of them is just riveting. It's like an action movie, practically. That's how much on the edge of your seat you are, just being deluged with this great, 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 really well-written dialogue. And the best actor in this for delivering the monologues is Peter Finch, who unfortunately died shortly after filming, but he delivers the I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take this anymore and scene in the movie that's just absolutely unforgettable. But I just love that performance.
Absolutely great, though. I gotta say, I'm of the camp that thinks the Ned Beatty monologue in that movie is even better than where he's talking to the Peter Finch character.
It's good, and you know, Beatrice Straight won an Oscar for supporting actress after, you know, only having 6 minutes of screen time, but she had a monologue that was very. There's so many you could talk about.
Right. Well, I think maybe a lot of people's favorite monologue in history comes from the end of Casablanca, and that's my number two pick, is Humphrey Bogart, who could do it like nobody else. And of course, his great, you know, you don't get on that plane, you're going to regret it someday, maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but soon. And ah, what a guy. And like you mentioned earlier, The Treasure of the Sierra Madre, and he's great in that too, with his crazy scheming and the way he goes completely nuts. But he's got a great monologue in The African Queen when he tries to convince the Hepburn character that he's not such a rotten person after all. And just a guy who, we've talked about presence, and here's a guy who has presence in a different way, not at all in a sort of classically trained sense or even in the same raw emotion and power you get from Brando. Sort of a persona and presence all his own, completely unique and just wonderful to have around. I mean, I think you could give Bogart just about anything, from sort of tender love scenes to going crazy mad scenes to just nice tough guy talk. He could do it all perfectly.
Gosh, you pick Lemon and now you pick Bogart. You're picking all my favorite actors. Well, I am going to pick my favorite actor for my number two, which is Spencer Tracy. And gosh, again, screen presence, charisma, real charisma. You like the guy no matter what who he's playing. And you can, you know, I don't know, just think of Judgment at Nuremberg or Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, or even, you know, the more comic monologues that he might have in Adam's Rib. The thing about Spencer Tracy is, not only is he likable and easygoing, but he's commanding at the same time. When he's on the screen, you listen to what he says, and you like listening to him. And he always looks like he's thinking. He never looks like an actor reciting lines he's memorized. None of these actors do, really, but he always looks like he's the character he's playing, thinking and feeling his way through a situation as it happens on the screen. And of course, you know, that's not how movies are made, and then part of being a good actor is conveying the impression that it really is happening on the screen at the time. And, you know, so, great actor, and he's great with monologues.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, to me, again, the key with these is people who have range, and you mentioned Tracy also has, of course, that great comedic side that you did touch on, and I think that's a wonderful thing, too. If you can do comedy and drama, then you're set, and he could absolutely do both. And you pick my number one, and I guess it's an obvious pick, but it's Brando. Is there a better monologue than the I Could Have Been a Contender scene from On the Waterfront? I mean, I don't know. And just think of it. I mean, oh gosh, a guy who helped redefine acting for the screen and acting in general, also on the stage. I mean, it's a guy who completely helped change the way we think of acting, the way we think of line reading, and a guy who took monologues out of that older, more static mode into the sort of raw power that sounds like people just pleading desperately with every ounce of their being, as though they need to speak the words or else they're gonna just curl up and die. I mean, here's a guy who. Just wonderful. I don't think you could ask for a better guy to read some extended monologue in a movie than Brando.
Yeah, well, I have one that I think tops your Brando pick here, and that's my number one. The single actor I would most like to have perform the monologues in a movie has a name that's pretty difficult to pronounce. It goes something like, ow, and he plays the Bushman character in the Gods Must Be Crazy films. I mean, he could do it all, really. I mean, you know, whenever there's a cop beating up a guy, I'll be there. You know, you can picture him as God is my witness, I'll never be hungry again. Oh, little lad, you staring at my fingers, would you like me to tell you the little story of the right hand, left hand? He can even do this one. Like, think about this one. Okay. Just imagine. All right. Yes, precious. First they will cheat you, hurt you, lie. Master's my friend. You don't have any friend. Nobody likes you. I'm not listening. You're a liar and a thief. No, murderer. Can you picture that? That would be fantastic. That would have been great with... Ow. But I can't honestly think of a part in a movie that he would have been wrong for. I mean, seriously.
Wow.
You don't have any response to that?
I'm stunned. I'm still trying to process your Gollum. I'm not quite over that yet. You're going to have to give me a few minutes.
Well, you know, I'm not the actor that ow is, so, you know, it's not going to come through the way, just me quoting it for you.
I think, really, I'm just going to let you do the rest of the show. I think that's about it for me.
All right, well, summing up Steven's list, his number six choice... I forget what your list was, I can't.
All right, well, my number six was George C. Scott.
All right, George C. Scott, he was in Patton, that was his number six. Number five was... I forgot that one, too.
Chris Walken.
Christopher Walken. great monologue. You know what? I only remember your number one because I had it on my list, so...
Of course.
I'll let you take the rest of it.
Well, my number four was Jack Lemmon. My number three, Orson Welles. Number two, Bogart. And number one, Marlon Brando.
And my number six is Walter Huston. Number five, Laurence Olivier. Number four, Marlon Brando. Number three, Peter Finch. Number two, Spencer Tracy. Number one, somebody Stephen would probably like to imagine I did not mention. The so-called New Hollywood directors were a generation of directors that came along in the late 60s and 70s and really modernized the kinds of movies that were being made. You know, think of things like Bonnie and Clyde and The Godfather, Taxi Driver, The Deer Hunter, and all these sort of definitely feel different from any of the movies that had been made in prior generations. And they'd be independent films today, but they were big studio films of that time. In the late 60s and early 70s were a real creative period. And a lot of directors emerged that became very successful and well-known. It's like a who's who now. You know, Martin Scorsese, Francis Ford Coppola, Woody Allen, Robert Altman. And, you know, there's a bunch of other guys. And then there's a guy that had every bit of the potential and promise for some reason just didn't ascend into that upper tier of directors, and that was a guy named Peter Bogdanovich, and I find him quite an interesting guy. He actually started out as a critic, sort of following in the footsteps of François Truffaut's, you know, again, we've mentioned before, even on this very episode, and certainly in past episodes, but Truffaut was a big inspiration for him, and Bogdanovich basically followed that sort of career path where he started out being a critic and then decided to try to make movies on his own. And so he became a director starting pretty small. He was working for Roger Corman, actually. You know, Roger Corman is the low-budget schlock producer that occasionally directed things. He did some of the Edgar Allan Poe adaptations with Vincent Price in the 60s. But anyway, Bogdanovich made a movie for Corman called Targets in 1968 with Boris Karloff. And against all odds, that turned out to be a pretty good movie. But the other one is called Voyage to the Planet of Prehistoric Women, which is every bit as cheesy as it sounds. I mean, it has a 1.7 IMDb rating. You can't get much worse. And from that, he turns around and makes The Last Picture Show in 1971. It's considered one of the greatest films from that time. And it's about life in a small, isolated town in Texas where this pretty much nothing to do, and the younger residents of the town get in fights and cross-linked affairs and so forth, seemingly just because there isn't anything else to do. And as the title suggests, you know, the one thing there is to do is the picture show, you know, the movie house. But as the title also suggests, that place goes out of business and really leaves the town empty of interesting things to do. What's really masterful about the film is the atmosphere it creates. It's such a real convincing place, this town, and where people really don't seem to live so much as exist. And it's fully realized with regard to the social dynamics of the place, too, which I think is the real heart of the film, is this division between the older and younger generations. You know, the older generation is settled and comfortable here, and maybe if they're not the happiest people in the world, they're content enough. They've come to terms with this lifestyle, and they know how to do it. So they lead perfectly pleasant lives, I guess. But the younger generation is restless, and as it usually is, you know, and not really understanding of how to live in this town. They're bored. They want to go out and, you know, do great things, and they kind of feel trapped here. And so they just kind of get involved in a lot of trouble because there's nowhere else to put that energy. And so, you know, the film is very good. It's a pretty heavy drama, so it's not going to be for everyone, but it's very good as a character study and as a study of a particular lifestyle at a particular time and place. And the film launched a lot of careers, too, in particular Jeff Bridges and Sybil Shepherd. And Sybil Shepherd would go on to star in a number of Bogdanovich films. But one of the really interesting things about The Last Picture Show is very rare in the movies, and it also ties into Truffaut. But 19 years later, Bogdanovich and his whole cast, and it's a pretty big cast of The Last Picture Show, but pretty much everybody came back to do a sequel 19 years later, 1990. And that sequel is called Texasville. And it sort of, you know, as I said, brings to mind Truffaut because he did this with the Antoine Doinel character that we talked about, making five movies with the same actor over a 20-year period. Same sort of thing happens here. We catch up with all these different characters many years later, I forget if it's 20 or 30 or whatever, but somewhere along those lines, and we catch up with them as they've grown up into adults, and the older generation is now quite a bit older, and there is a new generation that in some cases experiences a lot of the same problems they had as kids. Unfortunately, Texasville is not that great a film, but it's pretty interesting as an experiment, just because it's so unusual to see that. It's hard to figure out why it doesn't work, though. It's not obviously bad. It's just not as thematically cohesive like the first film, I guess. It's actually, a big thing is that it's in color. We've talked about the different effects of black and white and color. The last picture show was black and white in a time when black and white films didn't tend to be made. But Texasville was in color, and if you look at the two together and you really compare them, it's obvious how much of an impact that decision made. And I really think if the last picture show had been in color, we wouldn't really still be talking about it that much. Well, let's get back to the early 70s, because this is where Bogdanovich is just really shining. He actually makes... This is the first of three movies that are pretty much masterpieces, or at least close. He follows up the last picture show with a comedy called What's Up, Doc? And that starred Ryan O'Neal and Barbara Streisand. And it's a screwball comedy in the classic traditions of the 30s and 40s, these screwball comedies. We should spotlight this genre on a later episode, but basically the characters of What's Up, Doc? Are lifted directly out of Bringing Up Baby. The Katharine Hepburn and Cary Grant characters, they have different names and they're played by different people, but the characters themselves are lifted directly out of that. They're the same people, I swear. Different story, though. It's an original story, and it is good. It's surprising. Usually when you try to recreate something from the past, it doesn't usually turn out that good, but this turns out to be a pretty great comedy. It's one of my favorites, and you know, definitely, I think, the only screwball comedy made after the Golden Age that I think holds up. And so the third in this trilogy of great films he's done is perhaps his best, and it's Paper Moon from 1973. So, you know, 3 years, three movies. And Ryan O'Neal returns to star in this one with his daughter, Tatum O'Neal. And they're a father-daughter con artist team. And they sort of, I mean, the movie is primarily about their relationship. But they go on from town to town, and he kind of trains her to be his partner in as a con artist. And they have some small games and bigger games. And so it's one of those movies. If you like, you know, House of Games, you'd probably like Paper Moon. I mean, different sort of movie, but it taps into that same sort of appeal. You know, what is it that's so interesting about con artists? I don't know. But Tatum O'Neal was only 10 at the time and won an Oscar for her role in the film. And of course, it's a terrific performance, but very unusual for somebody that young. And as a side note, we also see Bogdanovich working in black and white again. So I don't think you can watch Paper Moon and not agree it was absolutely the right choice there, but just a wonderful character drama. And then things just completely fall apart. They go south for Peter Bogdanovich. It's just kind of too bad. You know, his contemporaries in this new Hollywood generation would do great work for a long time, and in some cases still happening today. Scorsese just won an Oscar. But Bogdanovich just... it just all falls apart, and you can kind of come up with reasons why maybe it happened, but basically his next movie was Daisy Miller, based on the Henry James novel, and that just bombs, very famously bombs, high profile, because there's a lot of expectations for it after these three great movies. And then he adapted a Cole Porter musical, At Long Last Love, and that bombs, and that one's sort of interesting because he recorded the songs live, which hadn't been done since the early 30s. This experiment... he was obviously interested in the way movies used to be made and wanted to try to do that, but he didn't really cast actors that could sing that well, and so obviously that backfired, but it was just seen as this huge ego folly, you know, wants to do these crazy things now and all for the sake of art, and it just doesn't work at all. And so he lost a lot of his reputation. And then came a movie called Nickelodeon, which reunites Ryan and Tatum O'Neal, trying to recapture Paper Moon, but it doesn't really work. So he has these big, high-profile failures, and his reputation and career just crash and burn and never recovers, really. I mean, there's some bright spots later on worth talking about, and we will, but for the most part, he's out of the picture now. And so that's why I said earlier that sometimes he's referred to as a good example for talking about auteur theory, because it's not just the director in play here. What happened between Paper Moon and Daisy Miller is his marriage broke up with Polly Platt. And Platt was, besides his wife, a collaborator. She was the production officially, she was the production designer and costume designer on his early films, and probably she served in an advisory capacity. She moved on and worked with other directors and became a producer more recently. But she's out of the picture in terms of Bogdanovich's career, and that's exactly when his career falls apart. So who is the author? You know, was it him? Was it her? Was it the collaboration? Was it the team? Or was it something else entirely? It's hard to know, but you'd think if it was all Bogdanovich that he'd eventually come back into his own. Or maybe not, I don't know. It's hard to know. These personal sorts of things, you never know how that's going to affect your work if you have that kind of stress. And if you think the breakup of a marriage is enough personal stress, it is another story. In 1980 or so, he starts work on a film called They All Laughed, which had a lot going for it. Primarily, Audrey Hepburn, absolute legend, retired from acting 13 years earlier, occasionally came out of acting, so this is one of her rare returns to the screen, and it should have been fantastic. I mean, Audrey Hepburn can make anything better. but she co-starred, this is kind of an odd pairing here, but she co-starred with Dorothy Stratton, the 1980 Playboy Playmate of the Year. And during filming, Bogdanovich and Stratton had an affair, and Stratton's husband killed her and committed suicide. And so that's obviously terrible. But the kicker for Bogdanovich is nobody wants to distribute this film for fear of the scandal that all that business caused. And so Bogdanovich distributes the film himself, spends millions of dollars out of his own pocket. Nobody likes it, nobody sees it, and he goes bankrupt. So, that's got to set you back a little. From the very beginning, though, all the way up to today, he's made considerable contributions to preserving film history. And so it's worth talking about this sort of second parallel career, and definitely he's done great things here. If you look at his films, things like What's Up, Doc, and even the failed ones, Nickelodeon is based on the early days of movies, it's clear he has this passionate interest in film history. You know, it's sort of like Martin Scorsese in this regard. He's a real film historian. He's made documentaries about Howard Hawks and John Ford, and he's written a dozen or so books about movies. Big fan of Orson Welles. One of his books is called This Is Orson Welles. It's a pretty definitive book about Welles. It's a conversation between Bogdanovich and Welles over a 5-year period. Anyway, certainly his contributions to film literature are massive and, in a way, more successful than his directing career. But I think definitely just from directing those three earlier films, that's enough to warrant an incredible amount of respect. So I don't want to be too hard on the guy, but it's just unfortunate that this sort of career path happens when a director has a lot of potential and just doesn't manifest itself. He also actually acts as well. He's mostly in smaller roles. Probably you're most likely to know him, if you know him at all, from The Sopranos. He plays Dr. Elliot Kupferberg.
Yeah, he plays the psychiatrist of Tony Soprano's psychiatrist.
Yeah.
He shows up regularly.
And he actually directed an episode of that show, too. But let me wrap this up by just picking two of his later films that I think are absolutely fantastic and really warrant quite a lot of respect that I don't think he got for it. And the first one in particular, it really failed in the theaters and in the early 90s and kind of cemented his status as not being a reliable director anymore. But after the fact on video, accrued a pretty strong cult following, including me. It's actually my favorite Bogdanovich movie and one of my all-time favorite comedies ever, and it's Noises Off. I've definitely mentioned this on the show before, but it's an incredibly fast-paced, all-star comedy about a group of competently incompetent actors and stagehands trying to put on a play. And we see them rehearse the first act, and it's a total mess. And all these personal relationships between the actors interfere with the performances, the kind of complicated intersections and everything. But so there's these scuffles and rivalries, and we see an actual performance of the first act in front of a live audience, but we see it from backstage. And by this time, all the actors are mad at each other, and so we get a sense of how their interrelationships have progressed, or rather, regressed. So from backstage, we see them go on to do their parts, and then they storm off stage, and then they immediately re-engage with their rivalries and everything. So we can really tell that their hearts aren't in the performances. So, you know, they just barely make their cues and that sort of thing. A complete and total riot. I love it, and you should see it. And then, later on, I mean, he did a bunch of TV work in the 90s, but then he returned to making a theatrical film in 2001 with a movie I really like. I mean, not as much, but I really like it. It's The Cat's Meow, where, again, he returns to the subject of early Hollywood lore. Basically, in 1924, the gossip columnist Thomas Ince died aboard William Randolph Hearst's yacht. Now, you know who Hearst is from history's the big media tycoon in the movies. He is the not-so-thinly-disguised real-life inspiration for Citizen Kane. But basically, Hearst took a bunch of people on his yacht, and it was a bunch of famous people. You know, Marion Davis was an actress at the time, and his mistress, so she was there, and Charlie Chaplin was in there, a number of other people, Luella Parsons, another gossip columnist. But anyway, they went out on this yacht, and this guy, Thomas Ince, was killed somehow. And the official story, and, you know, for all we know, that's the truthful story, is that he died of a heart attack. But there's a lot of rumors flying around that it was something more sinister than that. The rumor is that Hearst shot him, one of the rumors, and then he used his influence, which was considerable, to cover up that. So there's all these conflicting stories about what actually happened on the yacht. And one story is there's an accident that occurred while he was fighting with Charlie Chaplin. We'll never know for sure, but The Cat's Meow is this film that speculates on what might have happened aboard that yacht. And it's a wonderful film, I think. For starters, it looks absolutely gorgeous. I mean, these bright colors and costumes, great acting. Not just great acting, actually, but likable acting as well. Sometimes you get a great performance that, you know, you admire, you don't really like it. I really like the acting in this, the characters. Edward Harriman plays Hearst. Eddie Izzard, of all people, the British comedian, plays Charlie Chaplin, but he does a really good job with it. Kirsten Dunst plays Marion Davis, and Cary Elwes plays Thomas Ince. And there's Joanna Lumley and Jennifer Tilly, and, you know, just a weird mix of people, but a likable mix of people. I really liked it. It sits well in the memory. Not the obvious masterpiece that his earlier films are at all, but, you know, it's likable and good to look at, especially if you're interested in that early Hollywood history. So you've seen this one, Stephen. What did you think of that?
I think it's a lot of fun. I don't know that there's a lot to it, but it's very interesting, like you say, especially if you like that period of time. I don't know. My general impression of it was kind of a light, fun, interesting movie that doesn't necessarily have that much substance to it. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm not getting enough out of it.
I think I liked it a bit more than that, but I have a similar sort of reaction. I know what you're saying. So, what's next for Peter Bogdanovich? Because he is still working. Recently, he was hired by Clickstar to host a movie channel and also write a column for their website, so you can go there and read that if you're interested. Later this year, he's shooting a new movie called The Broken Code, which is about the controversial discovery of DNA. Kind of an interesting subject for a movie. I hope it does well. Certainly, he has the potential to do great work. It's just, you know, sometimes it happens, sometimes it doesn't. Anyway, if you're interested in experiencing Bogdanovich's work, check out Noises Off and What's Up, Doc, if you're into these madcap comedies. Or if you're, you know, you like the character dramas, you appreciate a really good one that has some meat to it, you can sink your teeth into, check out Paper Moon and The Last Picture Show. Good stuff. All right, well, it's the end of the show, and so, of course, we'll have to wrap up the trivia question that we asked earlier, which is, what character is in the Guinness Book of World Records for appearing in more horror films than any other? Do you got a guess for this, Stephen? What do you think might be a character that gets used a lot?
It's got to be Count Dracula.
It is Count Dracula, and I don't know if the number of... I'm going to give you the number of films. I don't know if that includes Nosferatu, which is, you know, officially a different character, but really the same one. But do you have a ballpark idea of how many movies that Dracula has been in?
Oh, man. 200?
It's a little high, okay. Little high, but pretty close. It's 162, at least by the way the Guinness Book counts.
Well, you know, there's about 10 or 15 a year, so maybe since...
Just about.
I don't know.
Maybe since then it's 200, right.
That wraps things up for us this week, but as always, check out the website, allmovietalk.com. If you know the name of the show, All Movie Talk, you know the name of the website, allmovietalk.com. We'll keep you updated with tons of information about upcoming movies and recent movies and movies we love and strange topics from the past. If you're interested in movie history, be sure to check us out, especially on Thursdays, because Sam is going to, all as he always does, post great information about movies from the bygone days.
And also check out rinkworks.com. That's RINKWORKS.com. You've probably not heard of that website, even if you're a faithful listener, but it is a pretty good site, so you check it out. Next week, we'll be back, and we'll talk about the most powerful handgun in the world and the guy that carries it. That would be Dirty Harry. And we'll get back into some Film Buffs Dictionary segments about the more technical aspects of filmmaking. And our top six list, movie dates. Kind of a weird subject, but if you think about it, for all the romance in movies, there aren't a lot of people going out on actual dates, and so that's going to be our top six list for next week if you want to think about your choices before we get to it. So, see you in about 7 days.